Day one is in the books since scouts are on the road for day two of the Pro Farmer Crop Tour. Some of them are even getting a little wet there this morning. We've got results. We're talking livestock markets, and we'll hear from Greg Peterson. No, not that Greg Peterson.
Live from inside the Crop Tour bubble via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, we'll talk with Tour Directors Brian Grady and Jeff Wilson. Then it's Professor Jason Lusk from Purdue University's Ag Economics Department. And then we will talk with Greg Peterson, not Machinery Pete, about the upcoming Farm On Benefit Concert. And right after the news, Annalisa Laca from Farm Journal's Milk. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson. Now, here's your beloved host, Chip Flory.
All right, Davis, thank you so much. Appreciate it,
baby.
Buddy. Here we are, day two. A little bit of rain out in the eastern Corn Belt this morning. Yes.
Okay.
Actually, more than a little bit of rain is what it looks like. I've talked with Brian Grady already this morning, and let's just say that he was not his normal cheerful self.
Is that right?
He might be a little, because of the wet conditions out there.
Perhaps a song will lift his spirits. Does that help at all? Does that help at all? A little song to lift his spirits?
I hope
that's what we've got him for. Yeah,
I hope it does.
It is so 2020 to just bring in the forecast of being bright and shiny all day or all week, and then to pour on Brian Grady.
Yeah, that is pretty 2020. That is Emily Carlin right there. She is working with the Crop Tour and with us here at Pro Farmer and helping us with the data. She manages the data as it comes in from the scouts. Yesterday, the guys did great.
They did fantastic. I mean, we thought that with the number of scouts being down and everything, I think that everybody put it into overdrive yesterday and pulled more samples than I've ever seen. There were groups of two that were coming in with more than 22 stops yesterday. It just super impressive.
Yep, really was. Davis, you got the results from yesterday?
I do. In fact, scouts in both South Dakota and Ohio found dramatic increases in yield potential over last year, with the South Dakota corn yield estimate coming in at 179.2 and Ohio scoring 167.69 bushels per acre. Soybeans were also solid, with South Dakota pulling a pod count in a 3x3 foot square of 1,250.86 and Ohio at 1,155.68, both. Well above year ago.
Oh, yeah. The 50% above year ago. Okay. That does not mean that we are expecting a 50% increase in the yield in South Dakota or the yield out of Ohio from what we saw last year. That's not how it works. Is it a better bean crop than what we saw in those two states last year? Absolutely. This bean crop up in South Dakota, Emily, when you were looking at the data as it was coming in, you get to see some of the notes that the scouts make on there. Did anything catch your eye?
I mean, really, the moisture. The moisture definitely was the number one thing that we noticed out there. And there's a lot of pods. Oh, my goodness. There is a ton of pods that were collected. But we've got to be able to finish that crop with a couple more good rains. Even though our maturity was ahead, it makes me nervous both on that corn and that bean crop, that even though there's a lot of grain that's there, it could still come up shy because of kernel depth issues and pollination issues that they definitely saw out there yesterday.
Right. Yeah. And you know, when you think about the moisture requirement on a crop that is carrying that many pods, it's pretty impressive.
Our beans aren't going to be as big, right? So when we talk about last year, and it's not like all of a sudden we're just doubling the amount of bushels that are going to be out there.
Not happening.
It's the size of those beans that we really need to take a look at, too, and we need to put into our evaluation when Pro Farmer comes out with their final estimates on Friday.
Yeah, and one of the things that's going to go into that evaluation is that, and I know this from looking at 27 years worth of soybean data. Okay, I know this. When you get above 1,150 pods in a 3x3 foot square, you start to get diminishing returns. I'm not saying that it's a negative. It doesn't hold yield down. You just don't get as much of a yield bump as you do when you get that move from 1,050 to 1,150. That's a big bump in yield. But once you get past 1,150, like I said, it's diminishing returns.
You stall out on that weight of each bean.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. There were comments about the two bean pods.
Yes. yes, we had lots of comments on two bean pods, but we also had a lot that's already had that cherry on top of that bean crop right at the top of the plant that was putting on quite a few pods. So that, I mean, that can be a 10% increase in your yield right there, because if you can finish strong through August and bring the pods, it comes.
Right. So, you know, when you've got more pods, you're going to have more two bean pods. That's part of the reason that you have a diminishing return when you get above 1150. So a lot of things going on there, but we're going to talk more about it with Jeff Wilson and Brian Grady coming up here in just a little bit. All right, let's go ahead and finish up the news. What do you got, Davis?
Well, sure thing. Meanwhile, export sales, quite the deal here. I've got USDA reporting daily sales of 195,000 metric tons of corn to China, 130,000 metric tons of corn for delivery to unknown destinations, and 130,000 metric tons of soybeans for delivery to those unknown destinations, all for the 2020 and 21 marketing year. This after 130,000 metric ton wheat sale yesterday,
right,
Chip.
Yeah, no, this is a fantastic run of demand that we are seeing for corn, for soybeans, and it was nice to see wheat join it yesterday. So it's really good news. One thing that we got to be concerned about, though, is are we going to push the price up enough eventually to shut some of this demand off? I hope we don't, not right now. I would just soon see the demand keep rolling in.
Right. Hey, let me hit these highlights from the crop progress and condition report. Corn, 76% doe, 23% dented, 69% good to excellent. Beans, 96% blooming, 84% setting pods, 72% good to excellent. Spring wheat, 30% harvested, 70% good to excellent. Cotton, 80% setting bolls, 15% opening bolls, 45% good to excellent. And winter wheat, 93% harvested, buddy.
All right. Thank you very much, Davis. Let's bring in Annalisa Laca. She's the editor of Farm Journal's Milk. How you doing, Annalisa?
I'm doing great. How are you, Chip?
Real good, real good. I've got Emily sitting here. You know that she's from Dairy Country.
Hi, Emily.
Yeah.
Hello.
I'm going to get out of the way of this. How do you guys figure out when it's time to start chopping silage?
Well, Emily and I had a good little email exchange about this a couple of weeks ago, talking about the importance of evaluating whole plant moisture when we're considering when to chop. And we recently did a poll on Dairy Herd that shows producers are starting to think about in the next few weeks. Getting underway with silage chopping. So I'd be curious to hear, Emily, what it's looking like up north.
Yeah, so up in western Wisconsin is where I'm located at in every other week besides this one throughout the year. And so what we're going to start to do is, I mean, we have talked about checking moisture a little bit earlier, you know, running some samples through a wood chipper into a harvest lab, you know, using some of that technology that's out there and available to get a good idea of where not only our moisture is sitting, but also our fiber digestibility, some of those constituents that we want to be able to evaluate and get just right on schedule, right? So as we're looking at that, I mean, we are talking about moisture's already starting to diminish because we do have a drought situation happening up there. We just keep missing every stink and rain. And so we will probably see moisture hit around that 65% or that half milk line, right where we want to be a little bit quicker than what we had anticipated. So we're probably going to be starting right around Labor Day up in Wisconsin.
So Emily, what are some things that producers can do? Because obviously we can't harvest every field at the same time. And sometimes we achieve that peak quality point at the same time. So what can producers do about that?
Watch GDUs. Measure how many GDUs to physiological maturity and really make sure that you've got it dialed in for when that peak harvest timing really will be.
All right. Hey, Annalisa, thank you. We'll talk with you again soon. Good luck. Good luck,
Thank
Emily.
You.
Good stuff. We'll talk to you in just a bit.
Crop Tour.
No doubt you've heard of MetLife, but did you know that MetLife Investment Management has over 100 years of ag lending experience? The MetLife Investment Management team maintains close relationships with its borrowers and can structure a customized loan with flexible terms to meet your financial needs. Looking to expand, refinance, or recapitalize? Consider MetLife Investment Management. Learn more at MetLife.com/ag.
The 2020 Pro Farmer Crop Tour is brought to you by Pioneer. For the best agronomic advice for your farm, count on your local Pioneer team for year-round advice. Pioneer, an American seed brand since 1926.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Got Davis Michelson with me. Got Emily Carlin with me here on Crop Tour. We're in the bunker, I guess you'd say, crunching the data as it's coming in here. So
the data bunker.
The data bunker, yes. All right, but let's get out to the field. We've got Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady with us. Brian is the leader of the Eastern leg of the tour. And Jeff Wilson. Jeff is the Pro Farmer senior market analyst and the leader of the Western leg of the tour. Gentlemen, thank you so much for making time. Beej, let's start with you. That 167.7 out of Ohio for the corn yield estimate. That was off of 108 samples. You guys did a great job pulling samples out of Ohio yesterday. It's up 8.6% from year ago, but boy, in the meeting last night, Brian, you made an awesome point and compared it to the three-year average and to 2018. That might be a better comparison for what is really kind of an average corn crop.
Yeah, you know, Chip, I think 2018 is the gold standard for Ohio. Yeah. They had record yield that year. You know, our numbers are off from that. 2018 crop tour in Ohio was 179.6. And we came in at 167.7, so down fairly significantly. It doesn't feel to me like the Ohio corn crop is the same as what it was 2 years ago when it was record large. Right. And I think the numbers back that assessment up. But it might be a different situation with soybeans in the state. I don't know. I think that if they get late season rains, even though our pod counts are down from 2 years ago, and they would be able to plump up and finish strong. I think it might be able to give a run at the record soybean yield in Ohio 2 years
ago. Gotcha. You know, I was a little surprised to hear the comments and to read some of the notes coming in from Ohio. That corn crop, it's almost like it never really kicked it in high gear this year in Ohio. It never went through that, hey, we're going to be a bin buster attitude. And as a result, I don't want to say that it's limping into the end of the season, but it's not going to finish all that strong, is it?
Well, I don't think so. You know, it's just like you said, it's really good. It might end up being the second best corn crop in Ohio. Ohio's one of those hit and miss states.
Yeah.
You've heard me say it over the years, and there's if it's hit, it can be really good, but there's a lot of misses too over time, and I think that there's just enough misses this year probably in that crop to keep it from being that record large.
Okay, so we had a big increase in the number of ears per acre, the ear population over a year ago. But it was interesting, the comment that you made last night, Beej, that we had a big increase, but it could have been even bigger.
Yeah, there were some skips out there, so it could have been bigger. And I think that part of that is it just shows that it wasn't ideal when it was planted,
right,
and when it emerged weather-wise, and the height of the corn too. It's not very tall, to be honest with you. It's really short corn compared to what we've seen in Indiana.
Right.
Yeah, Brian, one comment that came in from, or a comment that came in from quite a few of the scouts was the barren stalks out there too. So not only the skips, but barren stalks, and that just, I think, continues to share that you know, those are weeds out there to the other plants. And so that could be pulling down yield as well in some of those cornfields just because of the uneven emergence.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. No doubt about it. I mean, if you take the skips and the barren stalks out of it, we'd be talking about a fairly significant increase, I think, in terms of what the yield potential is out there.
Right. Okay, very good. Let's go out to the western side. Jeff Wilson out there. He's making his way through southeast Nebraska this morning. But let's go back north and talk about that South Dakota crop, because, Jeff, I'm really regretting not being out on the road this year to see what you guys saw up in South Dakota.
Well, that's because I had to be out here and leading the way to bring home the money. The South Dakota crop kind of reminds me of the Wisconsin crop. That's where I'm from. And it just looks really good. I mean, and everybody that's been on the tour for a number of years said it's the best South Dakota crop they've ever seen. And some of them have been doing it for 10 years in a row. And, you know, the numbers don't lie. The production is there. Number one, the ear counts up 3.6%. Grain length up 5.6%. And the number of rows around up 2.7% compared with the three-year averages. So those are big increases, which means everything planting went well. The summers had the timely rains. We had enough heat to get the crop going, and the yield turns out to be, you know, 16% above last year's tour estimates and 12% above the three-year average. So the corn crop looks very good.
Jeff, last year we were on Crop Tour and we were already talking about how hard it was going to get the pothole country fixed for this spring. And honestly, they had the fall and the spring that they absolutely needed to get every single acre planted. And they've been able to even control all of the weed issues that probably would have been popping up and had some fallow ground that really has some great potential out there. I mean, it's probably ground that hasn't sat like that for quite a few years. And now to see what that potential is, I mean, we definitely saw it yesterday.
Right. I think that's what Brent Judas, master scout from Cedar Falls, Iowa, said last night in the program, is that laying the ground fallow for a year makes a big jump in production or productivity. And, you know, I tried to get his guess on it, and he said 5, 10, maybe 15%. That's kind of what the numbers show. So, you know, when you have that many acres that are prevent plant, then they came back fast, and that's what they have to do in some of those areas south where, you know, you need that land to lay fallow for a year just to regenerate productivity.
Yep. Bean crop up there real quick, Jeff. It seems like it's disease-free. It seems like they've done a nice job of controlling weeds. Of course, there's going to be a few escapes here and there, but it sounds like a really, really beautiful bean crop.
Monster. It's record.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's what we measured yesterday.
Yep.
Still needs a rain, and that's what you'll get to those record type yields in many of those fields.
Yep.
But right now the pod counts are big. They're up 50% from a year ago, 36% above the 3-year average.
That's unbelievable to me that it's 36% above the 3-year average. I mean it's kind of shocking. Brian, talking about needing one more rain, you're kind of getting it this morning, huh?
We got it. We've now driven out of it, and skies have cleared off, and it's sunny, but it was definitely raining fairly hard this morning coming out of Indianapolis.
All right, where are you headed today?
We're going to Bloomington, Illinois, so I'm almost to the border here, crossing over into Illinois pretty soon. And, you know, we've seen stuff all over the place in terms of corn here in Indiana this morning on my route. Soybeans have been way more consistent, but quite a range on our corn yield estimates so far.
Okay, when you say that, and throw yesterday afternoon's observations in Indiana into it as well, better than what you saw in Ohio or not?
Well, I think the top end is definitely better, the variability here in Indiana makes it unknown. But I would say just history says yes, Indiana will out-yield Ohio.
Gotcha.
Brian, you're probably starting to run into some storm damage too, aren't you?
I had one field that had some wind damage in it. It was lodged. It wasn't too bad. It just took me extra time to count the rows and separate the rows and count the ears.
All right, stay at it, buddy. We're going to cut you loose. Stick with Jeff Wilson here for just a second. That's Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. We're going to stay with senior market analyst Jeff Wilson. You've been through quite a bit of Nebraska already now, Jeff. Give me your early thoughts there.
So coming south into Nebraska from South Dakota, things turned a little bit dry, and you could see it. And then, irrigated fields are what they are. They're probably going to be, you know, average in that 200, 210, 220, 230 area. There were a few problems in some of those fields from what I've picked up from other scouts in that northern area. This morning, what I've seen is it's same story. The irrigated fields look pretty good. We're down in an area that got a little – I'm in the south part of the state, just south I-70. So it's – it's a story that irrigated is good. It's probably not going to be anything that's going to be great. The dryland fields are probably going to be maybe a little bit better, and they may help to bring things up a little bit. It's kind of the story. The beans, consistent, lots of pods, but not very many blooms. So these beans definitely need a rain.
Okay, very good, very good. Hey, Jeff, thanks, buddy. Safe travels making your way over to Nebraska City. We'll talk to you again later.
All right, Bill.
All right. You got to go to profarmer.com, get registered. Just click on the red bar at the top of the page. Get registered for tonight's virtual crop tour meeting when we will have the results. Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Jeff. We'll be back with Jason Lusk in just a moment.
The 2020 Pro Farmer Crop Tour is brought to you by Pivot Bio Proven. Predictable, productive, weatherproof. Get a reliable partner. Get the new nitrogen. Get Pivot Bio Proven.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
Yeah, I'm going to take Brian's place again today. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be doing it all week. Take a look at what's going on in these markets. I want to point out that the equities markets, we've got the Dow and the S&P 500 under a little bit of pressure here this morning, but surprise, surprise, the NASDAQ is pushing to the upside once again. Crude oil is under some slight pressure. Natty gas prices are higher, and we've got a little bit of pressure on front month ethanol futures this morning. Over in the corn trade, 1 to 3 cents lower in corn. Soybeans, call it steady to 2 cents lower. Soybean meal is $1 to $1.50 lower. We've got a little bit of strength going on in soybean oil futures this morning. Now, yesterday on the support from that 130,000 metric ton in export sale that was announced by USDA, we saw wheat prices push sharply to the upside. Today, they're giving most of it back. We've got SRW wheat futures, call it 7.5 to 10 cents lower. Hard red winter wheat futures, mostly in that 7 to 9 cent decline here today. In the livestock trade, front month live cattle futures dimed to 25 cents lower. In the back months, we've got anywhere from 40 to 55 cents higher. Feeder cattle futures right now trading about 50 cents to $1.15 higher. In the lean hog trade, got some pressure there today. Call it 50 cents to $1.50 lower in lean hog futures. It's about demand, and it's about weather, and it's about the crop tour is what the focus is right now. I think the simple fact that that corn and soybean market has decided to trade very close to unchanged, even with some export demand in the market, is an indication that we're still trying to figure out what the size of this crop is going to be and how much damage was done. That's Markets Now.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. AgriTalk is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
AgriTalk! Crop Tour.
Crop Tour.
Crop Tour.
Crop Tour.
Crop Tour.
I'm super excited.
See, that was Grady from last year.
You're right.
I'm super excited.
And he's still super excited. He didn't even really sound like he minded the rain that much.
No, he didn't. I don't think he did.
I know it. That was awesome. Well, another guy that got to enjoy some of that rain this morning, Jason Lusk. Jason is the head of the Ag Econ Department at Purdue University. Joins us right now. Jason, it's good to talk with you again. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Good, good, good. I tell you, when you see a study that was done by Tonser and by Scholes and by Lusk on what's going on to the price in during a certain period of time, you know that you're putting some brain power into this study. It's really cool that you guys got together to do this.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of controversy and attention on livestock markets over the past 6 or 7 months. And it's just one of those things where we thought, you know, we kind of had to put our minds together and have something to say about what we thought was happening over this period.
Yeah, yeah. Please tell me that you got to do some of this face to face.
Oh, alas, no. We did a couple of Zoom calls.
Okay.
No, we're unfortunately just like everybody else, distanced from one another. Although we keep, I don't know, our collective tab we keep putting on each other's bar bills keeps growing the longer we stay apart. So.
I love it. You know, and the reason that I say that is the study is fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic, and it takes a deep dive into what was going on during the COVID reaction, I guess we'll call it. But if the conversation would have been just that much more free flowing with all three of you in the same room, I wonder if the results would have been any different or anything like that, you know. And I don't think that it would have been. I just think that we might be missing out on some more perspective based on the fact that you guys didn't get a chance to sit down and go over it. So let's talk about this. And, of course, let's start with the beef side of things, Jason, because that's where the big impact – you know what? No, let's just start with beef. And I'm not going to put any qualifiers on that quite yet. It is so amazing. We've never seen it proven more clearly – that there is a difference between a beef market and a cattle market, correct?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. And that's probably a good way to put it. These are markets for two different things, even though they're obviously linked in a fundamental way. There are certain times and certain situations when you can cause markets for those two different things to move in different directions.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've seen it before. And I think that's one of the things we said in the paper that, you know, there was some controversy, of course, around the packing plant fire that happened in Kansas,
right,
in the fall of 2019. But boy, that was just kind of like a, compared to what happened during the COVID shutdown.
Right.
You know, that was just I think we called it a prelude to a much bigger event that we saw happen then. And yeah, and it doesn't happen often. I mean, you know, I think in normal times, regular times, we expect those two price series, livestock and meat markets, to move at least not in perfect tandem, but to have, you know, at least a positive correlation.
Mm-hmm.
But there can be unique events that cause them to move in different ways. And we saw it during the fire. We saw it during the pandemic.
Right. Right. Thing that as we were evaluating during the pandemic, the thing that left me with a lot of uncertainty in what was going to happen going forward was I could feel the beef price increase coming because of the reduced production of beef, but I didn't know how that was going to be offset by the lost restaurant demand, by the lost food service demand. Talk about that and how it played out.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. It's one we didn't address a great deal in our paper, but I think it's a great point you're making. And if you were calling me, you know, in early March and said, uh-huh, Jason, a pandemic's coming, it's going to shut down restaurants by and large, what do you think is going to happen to meat, you know, to beef prices? You know, it would be hard to predict because,
yeah,
you know, about half of our consumer spending is away from home. Now, in terms of pounds, it's probably not that much, you know, maybe a third to a half or something. But you know, you lose that demand and you might think, well, you know, that could depress prices.
Right.
But and you can kind of see that actually a little bit. So early in the pandemic, mid to late March, wholesale prices got pulled up, but then they fell back down. And I think that falling back down, mm-hmm, was a direct result of probably aggregate demand was falling somewhat after we got over that initial kind of stocking, right, up period. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that we lost a lot of food service demand. But
right,
then, you know, the real driver that really moved the marketing margins and the price spreads that were the source of the controversy, that wasn't really a demand-driven thing. That was a supply-side shock,
right,
that happened from the shutdown of the meat processing plants.
You know, as crazy as it was, at one point we were looking at our processing capacity off about 40%. As crazy as it was, don't you feel like the markets kind of functioned as they should have?
Well, I think, you know, to be honest, that whole piece that we wrote is in large part trying to say that in probably a much more complicated way than you just said it. you know, if you shut down processing capacity, you know, that's going to push down, you know, livestock prices,
yeah,
because, you know, there's just not, you don't need as, you know, there's too many livestock floating around relative to the ability to process them. So the demand for livestock falls at the same time, because processing is closed down, we're producing less meat. There's less meat on the market, mm-hmm, means you know, buyers, consumers, we're left competing for a smaller amount of meat. We're pulling up prices, and it's almost exact the directions, at least. Now the magnitudes are harder to predict, but the directions of those price movements are exactly what I would teach in my, you know, Econ 101 kind of class about what we would expect if a packing plant closed.
Right. Yeah. Okay. On the hog side of things, back up again here just a bit to cattle. Cattle over the last 10 days or so, that market seems to be feeling more normal. I don't think we can say that about the hog market yet, Jason, and I don't know when we will be able to say it.
Yeah, and so that's probably just due to the differences in the biological lags and supply chains associated with those two different industries. But, you know, while both cattle and hogs have been affected by this backlog that was created by those shutdowns, you know, I think it's probably the case that pork suffered more from that backlog. Cattle, you leave them out on feed a little longer, you know, not move them into the feedlot. There's just a little more flexibility due to the biological nature. I don't want to come across as saying it's easy or there weren't economic harms. There certainly were. But if we're comparing, I think the disruption to the supply chain in pork was just much more severe.
Right. Yeah. So from an economist's point of view, what did we learn that the processors should be applying going forward?
Yeah, I think, you know, there. Well, I'll tell you what a lot of people think they learned and maybe what I think I learned. So, you know, one of the things that's coming out of this is I think a lot of people have argued we need more, you know, distributed packing, more, a larger number of kind of smaller packers. And that could be, but I think the real issue in the heat of the moment, you know, in April and May was, you know, there just wasn't enough excess capacity in the system. There was just nowhere for animals to go whenever we had this kind of shutdown. And that's a pretty tough problem because excess capacity is expensive. Nobody's going to want to, you know, spend millions of dollars on a packing plant to leave it running, you know, not to leave it idle, or at least, you know, idle big parts of the time. Yeah. But you know, even still, if you were a packer and shut down, I think that's one thing that maybe a lot of livestock producers haven't appreciated as much is, you know, they were losing out on huge opportunity, you know, that you look at those wholesale prices and how they moved. Man, if you weren't running, you weren't capturing those.
Right.
So even within some of those packing plants, you know, there may be an incentive for them to think about, well, you know, maybe it's worth having some excess capacity around just in case, you know, something like this happens again. We'll be better poised to take advantage of some of those opportunities. But, you know, and I think this geographic scale and distribution will play in on some level too, even though it's expensive. I think, you know, you incur big costs like that, you start thinking about insurance and maybe paying a little bit so you can avoid some of the worst outcomes that we lived through.
Yeah, boy, you know, we've talked about the vulnerabilities and so on. Obviously, when we talk about that pinch point on the processing side, it's labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is a longer term solution, but you know, what can we do to deal with some of those labor issues through automation? And you know, this is a problem before the pandemic.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to believe, but you know, 5 or 6 months ago, the problem was the economy was really hot. You know, it was hard to find enough workers because the unemployment was so low. That's a very different world than the one we live in now. But that was very much a labor problem from a very different kind of angle. It's a hard, automation is a really hard problem in meat packing because we're dealing with animals that are different sizes and shapes and meat that's wet and, you know, frankly, bloody. And, it's not like putting together car parts.
But
it's still not impossible.
Exactly. Jason, we are out of time, but I want to do this again, have another conversation about the study and what it might look like going forward. Thank you so much, Jason. That's Jason Lust from Purdue University. We'll be right back with more.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture, and is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
Farm, you see, I load the corn, I load the
America's Conservation Ag Movement would like to recognize Valent for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
It smells so good, I see it now.
Ready?
I got the eye of the bull at dinner time, staring through the sunshine, cause I am farmer, and they wanna see me strong morning,
alright, welcome back to Agri Talk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Still got Emily Carlin with me, and Davis is back in Sparkle City. Joining us right now from the Peterson brothers, Greg Peterson. How are you, Greg?
Doing pretty good. How are you?
Doing real fine, real fine. Do you ever get tired of hearing those songs? I mean, that parody was really pretty cool.
Well, you know, I've heard them probably thousands of times, but They still, you know, I still appreciate them, but, you know, I think they might get old every once in a while.
Oh, no. I think you guys are probably more famous than some of the people that you've done parodies on. I mean, oh, fangirling over here big time, Greg. I really am. And I just got to say, I love your new collaboration with Pioneer. What you guys are doing together is, and I might be a little biased. I mean, I might work with Pioneer. So we're happy to be a part of the team here.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, we're excited.
Good deal. Good deal. So did you ever think that as you're taking your message out on social media, the way that you're doing it, that it would catch on and be as popular as it is?
No, I mean, when we started out, we were just kind of trying to reach some of our friends from the city, and
yeah.
And you know, we expected maybe a little bit more than that, but then it really took off, and even, you know, 8 years later now, we are still blown away year after year with how many people watch our videos and follow, and also, you know, many of the other agricultural people who are on social media. It's been really cool to see it all take off.
It's interesting to hear that you know, when you started doing this was for your urban friends, those that are not out on the farm, because it has resonated so well with farm country, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of what's funny is, I mean, I think over the years we've continued to try to produce our content from a perspective of, you know, we hope people from the city will watch this. We hope it's educational. But at the same time, yeah, a lot of farmers and farm families and especially farm kids, watch our videos and I guess it's there for everybody, and we're definitely okay with that.
Yeah, Greg. I mean, I love the innocence of your message, right? You guys are so honest about what goes out on the farm, and it's so impactful. It really is. What's one of your favorite parody videos that you thought had some of the best responses from some of the urban community?
Well, those first two probably had the biggest response, and they just were so far-reaching. It's been hard to duplicate anything like that, but I think the Pasture Road and Tractor Stuck are some of our more recent videos.
Yeah.
They're both parodies of songs that most people know, Old Town Road and Thunderstruck. And so we've seen a lot of comments from city dwellers who are like, man, I've never seen a video about farming before, but here I am, and I'm learning all sorts of stuff. So that's been pretty cool.
Greg, what's your motivation to do these? Why do you do them? I mean, it's not like you can just wake up in the morning and say, hey, I've got an idea, let's write this song and shoot this video today. It takes time, it's effort. What's the motivation?
Well, I think there's several motivations. One, obviously, we're looking to make a difference, looking to make an impact. But we also, it's something that I enjoy doing. I've always been kind of a creative, you know, I enjoyed being creative and putting something together. And that
you were in swing choir, weren't you? Greg, were you in swing choir?
We were all in different choirs in high school, and I actually sang in a collegiate choir. And
there
and
you
then
go.
We did band. We did all sorts of stuff. We've been in music our whole lives.
See, so, now that was not a slam coming from me because I was in swing choir too. Okay, I just want to know. So,
nice. So
back to your motivation there. I'm sorry, I had to interrupt with that. But back to your motivation because getting the message to those to the city dwellers, like you said, in a format that they find easy to take in. That's a whole lot better than cornering them at a grocery store and saying, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you eating that? Why aren't you doing it? It's just an easy way to consume the message that you've got for them.
Yeah. And I think I've always thought that we, you know, live in an age where it's never been easier to connect with people from the city. I mean, we carry around a device in our pocket that can connect us with thousands or millions of people. And so that's one of my motivations is that, yeah, it's making a difference. But also, like I said, we enjoy doing it. And, you know, it's even provided some off-farm income for the three
Good.
Brothers. Just, you know, we wouldn't probably all three be farming together if we weren't able to supplement it with some of this other stuff we're doing.
That's awesome. That is awesome. That is so cool to hear right there. What are you going to be doing for the benefit concert?
We're going to be singing Chore, which is one of the I heard the song playing there in the intro, which
yeah,
it's one of our favorites, and that was the first time we'd ever done an acoustic performance, so I broke out the guitar and I was able to learn the chords, and so hopefully people enjoy it.
All right, very cool. Were you in 4-H?
My brothers were. I was more active in FFA.
Okay.
They were more active in 4-H. I was the guinea pig. I was the oldest child. So for some reason, my parents messed up on that one. I wasn't in 4-H. But I think Nathan and Kendall really enjoyed it, and they always have lots of things to say about their involvement and want to admit to them.
Excellent, Greg. Well, I'm really looking forward to the charity concert. All you got to do is go to farmjournalfielddays.com and get registered for the concert. Get registered for the field days, and there's still three more crop tour meetings coming as well. Greg, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
All right, that's Greg Peterson from the Peterson Brothers. Okay, thank you so much for listening this morning. Come back this afternoon. Jeff Wilson, Brian Grady are going to be drilling down on some of the specifics of what they saw today. Davis will have perspective along with Dan Huber. Tomorrow morning, Kevin McNew.